Welcome to the All About Jack podcast. I'm William O'Flaherty. Today, Connor Salter joins me as co-host to help me explore the following. Disability, what does Lewis's doctor teach us? Lewis's doctor's name was Robert Havert, and he wrote the appendix to The Problem of Pain. This is the first of a two-part episode. The show begins with me asking our guest, Levi Anderson and Dr. Zachary Small, to introduce themselves.
Now, I know that Levi and Zach both bring a personal perspective to our discussion about pain and disability. So we're going to ask them to share about where each of them fit on the disability spectrum. Levi, go ahead and share a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I am a 28-year-old Caucasian male. I am currently a blind student getting my Master's of Arts in Disability and Ministry from Western Theological Seminary in Holland, Michigan. They're the only school or seminary in America to have any program wholly devoted on uniting disability and ministry. And I felt like the Lord was leading me to that. When I was 18, I fractured my skull in 8 places. I lost a bunch of blood and my heart stopped twice. That's the short and quick of it. And I've recovered. I've relearned every motor skill, but I'm blind. I believe that God put this blockade in my life in order to help shed light on the fact that God's grace is not only sufficient, but his strength is made perfect in my weakness. And therefore, like the Apostle Paul, I want to go forth and boast in my weakness, if you will, in order that the Holy Spirit might shine forth.
All right, Zach, tell us a little bit about yourself from this angle.
Yeah, so as far as disability goes, I have spinal muscular atrophy, type 2. And what that is a genetic disorder related to muscular dystrophy, which you all might be more familiar with. But SMA is a progressive neuromuscular disorder, so I consistently get weaker. I started using a power chair when I was 3 years old. I've lived this way my whole life, so I don't really remember any different. However, I didn't really get interested in disability studies in this field seriously until I wrote my master's thesis at what was then Houston Baptist University, now Houston Christian University. And I wrote a thesis on disability and the problem of evil. Then I ended up pursuing my PhD in humanities. I went down some different academic trails for a time, but after I finished, I decided to turn my thesis into a book, which took a lot of editing and a lot of extending and a lot of work. And I'm grateful to my publisher for bearing with me, Public Philosophy Press. But through that work, I hope that people are able to wrestle with these issues. Because as Levi was just mentioning, as other people I've talked to who've read my books and who have shared these issues with me, sometimes you're faced with a disability in your life, in your family's life, and you don't even know how to begin to talk about it, how to begin to think about it, how to begin to approach God and say, God, why did this happen to me? And so that really is one of my primary hopes through conversations like this, hearing people like Levi and tell his testimony. I hope my testimony too speaks to that. So that is kind of where I fall on the disability spectrum and where I'm trying to work. Professionally, I am also an apologetics professor at Houston Christian University, and I am an adjunct humanities professor at Southeastern University. So I do live in that world as well.
This is the unedited article, Pain and Behavior in Medical Practice, which became the appendix to The Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis. Pain is a common and definite event which can be easily recognized. Although the sufferer may attempt to conceal, distort, or even exploit his pain, its real extent can be estimated with fair accuracy. but the observation of character or behavior is far less easy, less complete, and less exact, especially in the transient, if intimate, relation of doctor and patient. So an attempt to estimate the effect of pain upon general behavior must, it seems, be subject to large inaccuracies. In spite of this difficulty, certain impressions gradually take form in the course of medical practice, which are confirmed as experience grows. In the next few pages, an attempt is made to describe certain conclusions selected from a multitudinous and unmanageable mass of detail. A short attack of severe physical pain is overwhelming while it lasts. There is intense and obvious distress. There are the physical signs of pain, pallor, sweating, nausea, even vomiting, and a characteristic facial expression which cannot be concealed and can seldom be imitated. The sufferer is not usually loud in his complaints. He will beg for relief, but does not waste his breath on elaborating his trouble. His whole energy is devoted to fighting the enemy within him. It is unusual for him to lose control and to become wild and irrational. It is rare for the severest physical pain to become, in this sense, unbearable. When short, severe physical pain passes, it leaves no obvious alteration in behavior. It may have been met with courage and resignation, or with rebellion and despair. In either case, the patient seems to be little altered by it when it is passed. Long-continued pain has more noticeable effects. It is exhausting and is a greater trial of patience. Yet it is often accepted with little or no complaint, and there develops great strength and resignation. Pride is humbled, or at times results in a determination to conceal suffering. Women with rheumatoid arthritis show a cheerfulness which is so characteristic that it can be compared to the spes physica of the consumptive. But these examples of behavior are due more to a slight intoxication of the patient by his infection than to an increased strength of character. They are a sign of weakness, of diminished will to activity. They are not necessarily examples of an indomitable will surmounting the weakness of a diseased body. Some victims of chronic pain deteriorate. They become querulous and plaintive. They exploit their privileged position as invalids to practice domestic tyranny. They fail to achieve the heroism their long-suffering demands. But the wonder is that these failures are so few and that the heroes are so many. There is a challenge in physical pain which most of us can recognize and answer. On the other hand, a long illness, even without pain attached to it, exhausts the mind as well as the body. It produces weakness and fatigue. There is no vigor left to fight with. The invalid gives up the struggle and drifts helplessly and plaintively with a self-pitying despair. He will be found quietly weeping, yet when questioned is unable to explain why. Even so, some in a similar physical state will preserve their serenity and selflessness to the end. Their spirit shines more clearly through the weakness of the body. To see it is a rare and moving experience. Mental pain is less dramatic than physical pain because it is less visible, but it is far more common and also more hard to bear. The frequent attempt to conceal mental pain increases the burden. It is easier to say to others that the existence of an aching tooth than of a broken heart. It is easier to say, my tooth is aching, than to say, my heart is broken. Yet if the cause of the mental ache is faced and accepted, the conflict will only strengthen and purify the character, and in time the pain will pass. Sometimes, however, mental pain persists. The effect is frequently devastating. If the cause is not faced or not recognized, it produces the dreary state of the chronic neurotic, who is a bane to himself and to all with whom he comes in contact. Some, however, by pure heroism, overcome even chronic mental pain. They often produce the most brilliant work and strengthen, harden, and sharpen their characters until they become like tempered steel. In actual insanity, the picture is darker. The first sign of approaching insanity is often deterioration of character. In full developed insanity, the character is completely hidden by the disease, which takes possession of the character so completely that the phrase possessed of a devil is graphically descriptive. Our ignorance of the cause or cure of most examples of insanity is still complete. We are spectators, helpless to cure, alleviate, or even understand the suffering of the victim. In the whole realm of medicine, there is nothing so terrible to contemplate as a man with chronic melancholia. To speak with him has all the effect of witnessing high tragedy transferred from the stage to life. But most of the insane are not unhappy or indeed conscious of their condition. In either case, if they recover, they are surprisingly little changed. Often they remember nothing of their illness. It is impossible to form a conception of what insanity means to the sufferers themselves. But to look after the insane is valuable discipline. It teaches gentleness and self-control. It induces a deep humility when it is recognized that reason itself is a gift which can be lost. The biological purpose of pain is to draw attention to something harmful so that it may be avoided. Frequently, as in physical or mental disease, human pain fails to achieve its biological purpose. It then becomes a grave disorder. But the adversity of pain provides an opportunity for the development of heroism. The opportunity is seized with surprising frequency. Any view of life in which heroism ranks higher than comfort must see that the disorder of pain, when faced, is less harmful when its result is good.
Well, thank you, Connor, for sharing that unedited version. So before we get into more specific content from this appendix or the unedited version here, let me just get a overall reaction that you guys can elaborate on later here. So in no particular order, but I'll just kind of say, Zach, what has been your thoughts about this appendix, either from being familiar with it before or from Connor reading it now? What are some elements that stand out to you, good, bad, or indifferent?
Yeah, well, one thing that definitely stands out to me, especially hearing Connor read it out loud, because you really hear where the topic shifts. It's very well organized, if you will. He breaks down disability into several different categories. You can have short-term severe pain, long-term chronic pain. You can have physical pain. You can have mental pain. You can, it stands out to me that when he divides it into this many groups, it's actually something I think we'll dive into more later, but the question of how do you even begin to define what a disability is? Because it's a very tough challenge, and there are so many different definitions that to see it classified, it really stood out as Hunter was reading it aloud. So that's one thing I noticed, and just a very quick follow-up before I pass it on. And I know that the people at home are unable to see this, but the differences between the edited version in the appendix of the problem of pain and the unedited version we have, it's particularly interesting to look at what was edited out, especially as we near the end. That final line that Hunter read that's so powerful, any view of life in which heroism ranks higher than comfort must see that the disorder of pain when faced is less harmful than its result is good. That's a powerful line when we come to talking about theodicy, which I know we'll talk more about later, but man, I wish they wouldn't have edited that line out in the abridged version, because that is a powerful line.
Levi, if you would, go ahead and share some of your overall thoughts.
I love the appendix, and I agree with what Zach was just saying, and that the difference between the edited version and the unedited version is quite vast. And I love the way that C.S. Lewis navigates the problem of pain. because we are in a world that prioritizes heroism, or we look for the next figure, the next idol. It's almost like we worship them. Like, I love football, and most of America loves the Super Bowl. And we can almost put teams, put people, put other finite creatures on that level of idolatry. And so this book, for me, it led me to believe some, or to think of something else that is so easily done and so wrong that finite man likes to do. We're looking for something to live vicariously through, as opposed to looking at the fact that God has reached down to us and said, "Hey, let me help you come into my body and live for eternity with me, with the Godhead, with our Trinity, with our community." And I find that very fascinating. But I also agree with Zach in that this appendix is very well organized, and how he put, C.S. Lewis put, the problem of disability, the problem of pain, the problem of people who are going through suffering, and put it in different categories, because I feel like they can be either lumped together and assumed and just written off, or they can be super scrutinized and so zoomed in that we lose the bigger picture. So those are my thoughts, but it was nicely mentally generating for me.
So Connor, tell us your thoughts about the appendix overall, this this unedited version.
Well, my immediate thought is I wonder about areas that have changed since then, since the 1940s. So his comment about what we know about mental pain would probably be a little different today, because there's been a lot of advancements with psychology and counseling. But what also strikes me throughout it is that even though, yes, there are words like in the insane, the patient, that feel clinical today, there is a deep sense of empathy throughout it. And I find that particularly interesting as we get to the end of it, because as we get into, he's going from this, each bit about the question of can this experience be an opportunity for character? And when he gets to the question of long-term mental pain of insanity, he's left saying, "Well, I don't think I can say that this produces character in us, because once someone is genuinely that, they've a lot, they've in that dark of a place, but at that artificial reality, I can't say that. But I can say that the chance to take care of them is character building and can be a great privilege." Which does, given that Havard was a practicing Catholic, it makes me think a lot of Henri Nouwen at the end of his life at the Liarche community. And you may remember at this point, Nouwen has gone from being I think a Princeton professor, possibly a Harvard University professor, to taking care of people with disabilities in France. And he says that he learns more and benefits more spiritually from caring from the people than they do from his care. So that same theme of who is really becoming, who is maturing, who is. Do I get, am I getting a great privilege to become more of a person by helping?
Well, now I want to make sure, even though it's been referenced, to underscore, as you just did, Connor, that this is from a 1940 publication, or the version we have in The Problem of Pain is from 1940 publication. So essentially, depending on what he may have studied since his original studies, this is kind of a snapshot, maybe not what everyone thought in the late 1930s. But as you're noting, how things progress now, this is almost 100 years. In fact, we could almost even say, because of his training, and in a moment I'll have you share about what we know about him, that a quick biographical sketch. So his original training is over 100 years. So with that said, Connor, go ahead and share what we know about Havard.
All right. So yeah, Havard has a curious biography. He did some work as a research scientist. He, I believe, publishes an article in the Journal of Physiology when he's still studying at Cambridge. It's something on, I think, I forget what it's on. It's on something like exercise. And apparently it seems to have been a pretty well-received paper at the time. But he's also a general practitioner. He has a practice in Oxford, and through that in the 1930s, he meets Lewis because he inherits a practice where Lewis is a patient. That leads to Havard becoming a member of the Inklings, and that leads to a number of strange nicknames. His name is Robert, but Hugo Dyson accidentally calls him Humphrey at one point, so he becomes called Humphrey Havard. Another time, in World War II, he's in the Navy for a bit, and he comes back with a beard, a full red beard. So Lewis calls him the Red Admiral. And on another occasion, he's supposed to pick up Lewis's brother, take him to the train station, and misses it. So the next time they meet, Lewis's brother Warney calls him that useless quack, which is not a comment on his medical. It's a comment on, you're supposed to give me a lift, but did you know? So, on a personal note, what we know is that yes, he was a doctor to Lewis and a Tolkien, attends the same church as Tolkien for some years. I believe they were neighbors at one point. Havard, I believe he spends the last decade or so of his life living at a senior citizen's home, caring for, actually it might be a disability community, but it's something like that. So there is a practical level of he is had a lot of firsthand experience throughout his life of caring for people of various kinds of pain and conditions.
Okay, very good. And then we've also noted the different pieces here and there, but go ahead and just re-summarize then in terms of what we know about the appendix that is in The Problem of Pain.
Basically, Lewis has written his first novel, The Pilgrim's Regress. And through that, he gets asked to write an apologetics book for a series. So he writes The Problem of Pain. And much of that book, of course, is dealing with the question of what is the point of pain? Is there a theological point to it? Does it affect how we believe in God? Because Havard is a medical practitioner, he contributes this appendix, which it appears Lewis edits it down to the version we get in the book. And Sarah O'Dell has done some great research discussing what changes might have been made. Part of it is we believe it's Lewis in the 30s. He has an interesting experience where he's taking care of a woman named Janie Moore. Her brother is living in the same house with Lewis and having a nervous break, a mental breakdown. So there appears to be the reason a lot of the mental pain stuff gets trimmed out, that may be that Lewis is reacting to his own firsthand experience of seeing someone go through become insane.
Well, very good then. Let's go ahead and look at some of the different elements or approach the appendix here from several different questions topics here. So Havard covers a lot of conditions: short pain, chronic pain, arthritis, and what he calls mental pain. Would some of these be considered disabilities today? And so we'll go with to both of our main guests here. I'll start with Levi. What are your thoughts on it?
My thoughts on it. Disability perceived by the world seems to derive or find its meaning in having a lack of something. Like, for instance, I am blind and people view it as a disability. Therefore, I lack the quality of vision. There we go. And various other things. So I fully believe that all these the things outlined in the appendix are disabilities perceived by the world. But I would like to say that the term disability was not made popular until many World War II soldiers returned home back to America, and the government thought that they could be rehabilitated. That's where the term disability was founded. Before that, it was. I mean, you can find human limitations going all the way back to Adam and Eve if you want to. Because we were made to be whole, to be the image of God together, all of us at the same time. God needs all of us in the body of Christ. We all have human limitations. Some are just more obvious than others. Like mine, is a very obvious limitation. When you see me walking around with my white cane, you might get tapped because I'm trying to look around. And bless my brothers and sisters who also have obvious limitations, but we all have a limitation somewhere in our being. And outlined here in the appendix are intellectual limitations, or I'm drawing a blank on other ones, but there's many other limitations that are drawn out. But we're all long suffering, and that's our calling to be like Christ, because in the book of 2 Corinthians chapter 12 verse 9, it says that our weaknesses make God's strength perfect, make his strength known. That being said, God doesn't need us to be weak in order to be strong. God just needs us to show our weakness in order to show his grace, his awesomeness, his power, his strength. That's my two cents. Take it over, Zach.
No, I agree very much with you. A lot of what you said there, and it is interesting. At the beginning, you talked about kind of the world's perception of disability, because when I was looking into it, and I was trying to write a book about disability, I thought, well, how on earth do you define disability when there are so many different definitions? Like, for example, some people look it up in the dictionary. Some people here in America might point to the Americans with Disabilities Act. Some people might, there are so many different ways that people have tried. And even though, like you pointed out, there are some similar characteristics, like I am unable to walk, you are unable to see, we lack a quality that other people have, or a function that other people have. Like it always stands out to me that sometimes even things that might not count as a disability almost act as a disability. And I'll use a biblical example for that. Well, let's take Job, for example. So Job, and his story, he didn't know that his pain was going to go away. As far as he knew, he was going to have those boils for the rest of his life. He didn't know that. Now God healed him, but when we're hearing Job, wrestling with his situation, he's functionally living like someone who will have chronic pain for the rest of his life. So he's processing living with a disability in that context. Oftentimes, people will say, if you break your arm or you break your leg, okay, you do not have a disability, because you will heal. And back to your point about the world's definition, you will be rehabilitated back to physical fitness, shall we say. But I find it interesting because, I mean, in this appendix, I think that model really hasn't changed all that much. I think most people would still look to these symptoms and say, okay, if you have long-term chronic pain, then yes, you have a disability. If you have various intellectual, emotional, social disability, you may have a disability. The one thing I will just throw in there before we go is there is a school of thought that considers disability as a social construction, right? Whereas I do not lack anything. I do not have a disability, but the fact that society is not fully adapted to me means that I am disabled relative to society. So if only we perfectly adapt the world, so that I can fully access everything, so you can fully access everything, so it's universal access, disability would cease to exist. Now, I take issues with that. I think our Dr. Havard would take issue with that, but that is a school of thought that is out there, that disability is a social construction. So I just thought I'd throw that in there because it is something that I think his appendix would be somewhat at odds with. He seems to take more of a medical view of what defines a disability.
All right. So moving into our next big question. Now, Havard talks about how he's seen patients handle pain, and then he considers whether it produces character. What do we say? Is this what theologians would call a soul-making theodicy? Let's start with you, Levi. What do you think on that?
Yeah, so I would love to talk about it first. In my theological studies, I have found that it's the best way to come at an issue once you have the components defined. So I'm going to throw it back to you, Mr. Connor, and I ask you to tell the audience what you are saying as a theodicy to help all of us get to the same page.
Well, I think usually theodicy means something along the lines of what is God's will in this case. And soul-making theodicy is usually the theological term for is evil existing as a way to make my soul? Is it producing character within me?
Awesome. Thank you for that. The short answer to your first question was yes. But to elaborate on that, I think many theologians, myself included, believe and think that the struggles that the Lord puts in our life are not merely because God's omnipotent. He wants to see us struggle. Ha ha ha. He's not sitting up in the cloud saying, ha, watch this dude struggle. But the things in our life are meant for us to grow, to be better, to be more like Christ. And Christ, who is fully God, referenced the hypostatic union from the Nicene Creed, he is a long sufferer. That's the whole point, that no man could do it. So God had to do it for us. He had to live perfectly and then die blamelessly in order to have a bridge for mankind to come into eternity. And so I think that humans who are suffering in any capacity, whether the world perceive it as a disability or not, we are becoming more like Christ, and that's our ultimate calling. Thank you, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And that is where we're going to go from that. So yes, I do think it is a soul-making or soul-shifting theodicy that we're becoming more like Christ in order to see his story unveiled.
Zach, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, and I mean, Levi, I love what you said, and that's excellent. I agree very much, and I also it's hard because the other side of a theodicy too is it is like you said, God is not up there in the clouds throwing trials in our lives like Zeus throwing lightning bolts. It's not just to torture humanity. It's not just to have fun and play around and see them dance and watch out and jump over all these hurdles. That's not what God is doing. But God has a good and perfect will for what He allows to come into our lives. So I love how you articulated that. Now it is interesting because I think about this appendix and Havard, and I go back and forth on this, and any of you can chime in because I'm curious your thoughts too. I don't know that Havard was intending to write a soul-making theodicy, but I think he did. But he doesn't feel like a philosopher. He feels very, here's the issue, here are the symptoms. And my observation is like, oh, people seem to gain favorable traits through it. It's a very scientific as opposed to a kind of a philosophical, if you're going to go read, it doesn't read like a typical theological theodicy. And yet, I think he's like writing, I picture him writing case notes, and then those case notes are evidence towards a theodicy, which is so interesting when you compare it to most of, you read your like Alvin Plantinga, God, Freedom, and Evil, right? And that's very philosophical. Obviously, it's not a soul-making theodicy, but it is a theodicy. And you're like, oh, this is heavy philosophy. And Havard is also heavy, but in a medical scientific way. It's such an interesting presentation of a theodicy. And so, yes, I agree with you, it is. When we meet Havard in heaven someday, I'm kind of curious to be like, did you mean to write a theodicy? Or were you taking notes and it just became a theodicy? Because you did.
Zach, I have 2 cents on what you first said. Do you know the acronym made popular by the song artist Drake? The acronym YOLO, what it stands for.
Yeah, yes, sir. You only live once.
Do you actually know that my Christian redefinition stands for Yahweh overcomes life's obstacles?
I did not know
No, very
that.
good.
I like it. So me and my roommate back in college redid that, and I just think it's funny because going back to what I said and what you redefined, God's not like Zeus. He's not just sitting up there saying, "Hey, jump over this obstacle, jump over this, watch this happen, watch this happen. You're gonna suffer, ha ha ha." And he actually said, "No, for all those obstacles that Satan put in your life, here's my son." And I think that gives due glory to God.
I hope you enjoyed this first of a two-part episode about disability, inspired by the appendix to The Problem of Pain that was written by Lewis's doctor. Be sure to catch the second part, which should be available within a week after the posting of this show. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty. My podcast, All About Jack, has been around since 2011. My YouTube channel is called Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. Be sure to check out my short features for 2024, Misquote Mondays, and Screwtape Saturdays. Thanks to Connor Salter for co-hosting and for the suggestion to do this topic. Likewise, thanks to our guest, Levi and Zach, for sharing their insights. Don't forget to check the description or show notes for links to items mentioned in the show today. Finally, everything I do related to Lewis is centralized at the website, essentialcslewis.com. And in case you didn't know, I've written two Lewis-themed books. The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was released in 2018. It examines 75 quotations credited to him that he either didn't write, or paraphrases of something he did, or without the context, could be misunderstood. Then in 2016, my enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters came out. It's called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Thanks again for listening. Please consider liking and sharing this episode with others.